WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This Friday is the 200th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille. Two centuries after the beginning of the French Revolution, historians are still debating what the significance of the revolution really is. One of the historians stirring things up is my guest Simon Chama, author of the new book Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. In his telling of the revolution, society in the reign of Louis XVI was more addicted to change than resistant to it. He sees the revolution as tragic because of its obsession with violence. He calls his book an argument in the form of a story, and he tells the story of the revolution in an almost novelistic way. Even reviewers who have criticized him for neoconservative revisionism have found themselves swept away by his telling of the story. I asked him about that day 200 years ago when hundreds of Parisians, mostly workers, took the Bastille. Chama says the initial aim of the crowd was to get supplies of gunpowder from the Bastille, but after they took the prison, they demolished it because it was a symbol of darkness and secrecy to which the aristocracy held the key. I asked Simon Chama to describe the actual edifice, the Bastille.
It looked extremely alarming, especially to the small shopkeepers and craftsmen, hatters, glovers, cabinet makers who were crowded into the area of the Faubourg Saint-Antoine. You have to imagine a sort of flat, packed area of little shops, and then rising above it at the western end of that area, these huge round towers, sort of eight round towers, each of them with 5 foot thick walls. There's a wonderful painting by a man called Hubert Robert, who submitted this to a public exhibition in the year of the revolution, which makes these towers look even more vertiginous than they actually were. They were about 75, 80 feet high, I mean, which was pretty high. So if you were trying to imagine a really awful dungeon, I mean, a kind of fortress citadel in the middle of a city, this looked very much like the real thing.
Well, in fact, it was built in the 14th century, right?
Yes, it was really built for military purposes. It was built for military purposes. One should, I'm on the whole of the view that there were plans to knock it down, and it's really generally accepted that it was becoming redundant. However, it should be said it was no Hilton. I mean, there was a time, in the time of Cardinal Richelieu in the early 1600s, when it was a very grim place indeed. I mean, people really were locked up, and the key was thrown away, and they had no hope of getting out. And it was traditionally the place where you could put prisoners of state, and the monarchy could define exactly who it chose to be as prisoners of state. By the time the revolution broke out, there were really not many people in it at all, and it wasn't really used for these rather sinister purposes.
What were conditions in the Bastille like under Louis XVI?
Well, like that good capitalist society, which I rather bizarrely paint Louis XVI's France to be, depended how rich you were. Not how noble you were, but how rich you were. If you had the money, you could have your own clothes, your own. The Marquis de Sade had his own library, had three extremely good meals a day. And many other people who were reasonably well off expected to have their meals brought in. You could go for exercise, walk in the little governor's vegetable garden or around on the parapet there. And there were not really many people who were desperately poor brought in there. A large number of the prisoners at that time were actually locked up by their own family. A historian working on the Bastille records some time ago, discovered that people appealed to the king to lock up members of their own family who were delinquent for one reason or another. And if they were locked up, the Marquis de Sade was locked up by his own wife and family, then the wife and family came to see them, and they were really treated quite well. The infamous parts were the parts immediately under the roof and the parts immediately below ground level, the very top of the tower and the very bottom of the tower. And their conditions were absolutely horrible, but those were the cells which hadn't been used for 20 or 30 years.
My guest is historian Simon Chama, and we're talking about the subject of his new book, Citizens, A Chronicle of the French Revolution. After the fall of the Bastille, heads were paraded around on sticks. Whose heads were they?
Well, they were the heads, in the first place, of the governor of the Bastille, a man called Delaunay. And then there were heads of other officials of the city of Paris, one of whom was responsible for the provisioning of Paris, for the providing of food. One has to remember this is a period of quite desperate hunger. The 14th of July was not just the day on which the Bastille fell, it was the day in which bread prices reached an all-time high, and most people existed on bread. Obviously, I feel sort of troubled about that display of heads, because I try and make a distinction in my book between understandable violence and violence which seems to happen once issues have been decided. I don't think it's at all surprising, in a way, that the crowd should have been very angry, and because they were, after all, extremely hungry. They had been brutalized by the old regime itself for a long time. And there was a certain amount of violence in the change of power in Paris itself. This was the kind of war between units of the army that stayed loyal and units of the army that didn't, and that had taken place on the night of the 12th. The violence which disturbed me more was the violence of punishment, of revenge, of display, the kind of thing when these heads were taken around. It was almost a kind of gloating revenge. There was a terrible moment, for example, when one of these officials, on the 22nd of July, actually, had his body had been mutilated and his head was stuck on a pike. And they managed to arrest his son-in-law, who was fleeing Paris, and brought him back. And they, before they, in fact, strung him up and cut off his head, they poked his father-in-law's head in front of his face and said, "Kiss Papa." And it's that kind of grim, black, rather awful joke, which I think throws a very sort of dark shadow, not just over the revolution, but even over July 89.
Well, you say that you think it's the period just after the fall of the Bastille that created the politics of paranoia.
Yes.
In the French Revolution. Would you give us a brief explanation of what you mean there?
Yes, I do. I mean, let me preface it by saying one shouldn't be too sort of smugly self-congratulatory on this side of the Atlantic about it, because the Atlantic Ocean is a very important difference in exactly this respect. I mean, there was no, as far as I know, no deep worry that really young America was under serious threat from a Canadian invasion. From the very beginning of the revolution, there was a sense that you'd done something very, very daring, or very, very naughty indeed, depending on how guilty you were feeling. And out there, there were people waiting to punish you. And they weren't just indeterminate people. They were the crowned kings of Europe. Marie Antoinette's brother, the Emperor of Austria, who was not a long way away. Belgium was then an Austrian possession. There was the King of Britain, who was just the channel away. Even the King of Spain. So in 1789, there were rumors flying all over the country that the British had landed on the west coast of France, even that there were Prussian units of the Prussian-German army that were about to bomb Paris from Montmartre, and above all, that there was going to be an invasion of Austrian troops from Belgium. So there was this terrible sense that there were enemies within and enemies without. And they seemed to be vindicated by the fact that literally 2 or 3 days after the Bastille fell, the king's youngest brother, Artois, the most reactionary of the brothers, fled the country. So you had this sense of saying, oh God, this is a very porous, fragile, dangerous thing. We must in some sense get them, whoever them are, before they get us. But you're right also to say that I think that it's this period between late July and November, I would say at the latest, which set the mould for revolutionary politics in many ways, some of which I don't feel were altogether healthy for the prospects of freedom. I'm not someone who really wants to criticise the revolution altogether, but I do make a distinction between, let's say, the first half of 1789 and the second half of 1789.
You say that in dealing with violence, historians have erred on the side of the squeamish, and that you wanted to return violence to the center of this story. So I want to ask you about the guillotine. We think of it, I think now, as a very violent form of punishment, but in a historical context, you say that this was actually supposed to be an alternative, a more humane alternative, right, to the type of capital punishment that was previously practiced.
Yes, that's right. It starts off, one of these ironies of Enlightenment humanitarianism, that it starts off with the best possible intentions, like the revolution itself, and ends up quite differently. It was proposed by a man called Dr. Guillotin, Ignace Guillotin, who had already had a reputation as something of a pamphleteer in the Paris elections to the States General. And he stood up very seriously and gave a powerful and passionate speech to the National Assembly, where he said, look, previously, there are two reasons why we should have this machine, as he called it. One is ideological and one is humanitarian. The ideological one is that previously, punishments echoed the legal distinctions which had divided people into commoners and nobles. If you were nobles, you were entitled to be beheaded by the sword. This was regarded as the dignified way of meeting your end. If you were a commoner, you were hanged. And if you were very unlucky and had done something very wicked indeed, like tried to attack a member of the royal family, you could be broken on the wheel, bits of you scattered in various directions. So he said, we are all going to be equal. We're all citizens. No matter how criminal the citizen is, everybody should have the same punishment. So the machine, in its kind of implacable equalizing level, was supposed to be a perfect revolutionary symbol. But he said, there's something else. There's another reason why we should have the guillotine, is that it's very humane. Nobody will feel a thing. He used the phrase in French that the guilty party would feel no more than the merest tickle on the back of the neck, after which the head would jump into the basket. Then he stopped, and everybody burst out laughing. I mean, it was kind of nervous, slightly hysterical laughter. The sort of laughter, I think, when one sees something awful, but something funny, you know, someone fall down and hurt themselves. And poor Guillotin was so dumbfounded at this kind of cackling that he said, oh, forget the whole thing. We'll just not do it. He was very dashed by it. And he did forget the whole thing until 2 or 3 years later, when it was taken up again, essentially as something that was going to be used for criminal justice. But by the time that happened, the leaders of the revolution, some of the most militant leaders of the revolution, like Robespierre, who had actually cast his vote against capital punishment earlier in the revolution, they were deeply worried that the whole process of the revolution was disintegrating into spontaneous bloodshed on the streets. I mean, they were particularly shocked by what happened in the so-called September massacres in 1792. So for these leaders, the key problem was, how can the state take back to itself, in the name of the republic, the monopoly of violent punishment which the monarchy had once enjoyed? So they took up the guillotine, not as this kind of piece of legal punitive surgery, something that would be done in private, no one watching, and instead the attempt was to try and sort of slake the popular thirst for punishment. So instead of putting it in a field somewhere, private, they stuck it right in the middle of what is now the Place de la Concorde, and moreover, facing the pedestal on which the statue of Louis XV, Louis XVI's grandfather, had stood. The statue had been knocked off when the monarchy had fallen in August. When Louis XVI was executed, the first big execution, really, in January 1793, he was stuck through what was called the national window, the little window, stuck through that sort of frame, and made to look at the naked pedestal on which his grandfather had stood. So this kind of theatrical element in the guillotine was really there from the beginning.
This gets us to a question that you think is one of the key questions in the French Revolution, which is, once you've initiated violence, how do you prevent it from working against you instead of for you?
Right. Nobody could figure it out. I mean, the guillotine and the terror, as I just said, was really a way in which the Jacobins, who were the last in a succession of people to be propelled to power by intense anger on the streets, they said, we can't have what they then called anarchy. And Robespierre, again, in his brilliant, rather icy, but really very intellectually, sort of cold-bloodedly impressive way, said, well, he said, we really have a choice here. On the one hand, we have what he called constitutional government, the government of laws, which is all very nice. Yes, it's true. It's what the Declaration of the Rights of Man stood for. But revolutions, you know, he said to everybody, are not peaceful things. We are fighting a war. We are fighting a war with traitors within and traitors without. We have to have revolutionary government until the peace. What revolutionary government until the peace meant dictatorship. So that instead of the revolution's reason being the rule of law, the revolution's reason, or the reason for revolution government, was now force, was now security, was now the interest of state. And it was in the name of that that the terror was unleashed on tens of thousands of people who came to the guillotine, and hundreds of thousands of people who were destroyed by the war in various parts of France. I mean, this does look forward in a very gloomy way to some of the crimes committed, in my view, in the name of revolutionary democracy in our own century.
Do you feel that history is always subjective?
Very good question. I feel it's much more subjective than most historians like to allow. I mean, we've been living now for 100 years under the influence of assuming that history is sort of like a science. In fact, one of my colleagues in France wrote a book a few years ago saying, look, the historians of the future, they're going to be just like technologists. We're going to walk around in white coats, fiddling with computer knobs. We'll have teams of helpers. It was sort of awful, actually, kind of, you know, kind of Alphaville, sort of metropolis image of what the historian was doing. But even while it's not gone that far, most historians say, well, you know what you have to do? You have to calm down. Always saying, Sharma, for God's sake, calm down, you know. Don't really come close to your subject. Distance, dispassion, objectivity. The historian is supposed to be somebody on a very high mountain, sort of peering through a kind of limpid atmosphere at these sort of mortals scurrying beneath, like little ants, and being able to issue these Olympian judgments about what's going on. I think in the process of writing this book, I came to feel very unhappy with this way in which one comes close to the past. So I've tried actually to push people's noses very close to the history. I mean, I don't know if it works. One can't, of course, run the illusion that you're really reliving in some way the French Revolution. But the first thing I wanted to try and do with this book was really kind of reconstruct a whole world. And there were times, you know, I really got kind of, I slept rather badly, I have to tell you, when I was writing this book. And it became a very painful and upsetting thing to do. I mean, people said, you know, oh, I know why you stopped when you did. You know, you didn't have time. You didn't want to deal with the late 90s. And there was a sense in which, you know, I was exhausted. But I think I was sort of getting morally very exhausted by it. And that's why I end the book with places of repose. I mean, I put my characters at the end in places where they can stand or sit still and say, my God, you know, what has happened to us in these last few years? And I was trying to think to myself, well, what has happened to this whole world that I've been dealing with as I've been writing about it?
Do you take a grim view of revolution in general?
Yes, I do, rather. I mean, I think that revolutions promise more than they can deliver by the sheer virtue of the fact that early on in the book, I talk about the revolutionary's obsession with electricity and say that by definition, they of course loved Benjamin Franklin, but then this business about the revolution coming as an electrical storm became very important for them. The way to have true liberty, to have true freedom, is literally like a bolt from the blue. One great transfigurative charge. I mean, it's no accident that Frankenstein is born in the literature of this period, really. One great bolt of electricity, and we will have a new man, a new personality, morally, politically, and so forth. It's the opposite of saying freedom might have to be secured by prosaic, grey, boring, parliamentary, legal means. I mean, one of my heroes of 89 is Madison, I have to say. Madison, in the same year that these tremendous hyperbolic utterances are being articulated in France about new men, Madison is gloomily scratching his quill on his paper and saying, look, it'd be wonderful if we were all very nice and very noble and very altruistic. The fact of the matter is there's always going to be parties. There are always going to be factions. People are always going to claim monopolies of virtue. What we have to do is try and construct a constitution which will let people make these claims without tearing the state apart. In other words, we have to construct a pluralist democracy.
On the anniversary of the French Revolution, do you think we've fallen into hard times for revolution, that revolution is getting a bad name?
Well, I think deservedly so, and I don't mind it, actually, I have to say. I think we're living through the death throes of the great revolutionary epoch. It's taken 200 years to emerge in some ways from that spell. I mean, in some ways, it strikes me, you know, it's maybe the enthusiasm of a British immigrant to America. I may be too Pollyannish about the American Constitution. But I think with all its ills, it's the American Constitution and to a lesser extent also the British unwritten Constitution with its Bill of Rights in 1689, which has really survived the test of time. If one's touchstone is what kind of political institutions preserve those wonderful axioms enshrined in the Declaration of the Rights of Man, one has to say the American and the British way have seemed to have survived better than the revolutionary way. One irony for me is that France, the Fifth Republic, is the revolution that the French Revolution never had. It's the revolution that was lost. Monsieur Mitterrand is exactly the constitutional monarch that France tried briefly to have in 1789 and lost, not only just through the fault of the revolution, but it has to be said through the fault of Louis XVI.
You're talking about America as a model. America had a revolution.
It did, indeed, yes. I'm not, in that sense, against all revolutions, all dramatic changes in political systems. That's why I'm, you know, my heart flies into my throat with excitement, along with everybody else, at what happens in the Tennis Court Oath and what happens in the first part of 89, a spectacle of a political nation managing to free themselves from the captivity of the past is not itself at all to be deplored. It's rather a kind of noble vision. It's when it follows that up with the kind of fetish of unity that I think it goes wrong, when it does not then, as it were, switch from high voltage to low voltage, from the sense of what we're about in a revolution is a community of brothers, of friends, this kind of charismatic attitude towards belonging to a new community, and say, well, this has been wonderful, drink of champagne, we now have to sit down with small beer and work out in practice the details of institution which will keep freedom safe. And that seems to me to have been a tremendous difficulty for revolutions, the revolutions of the kind that have happened since the American.
Will you be going to France for Bastille Day?
Well, I'd have to be on the plane now if I were. I'm not going to France. I'm not worried, I think, about being burnt in effigy or being... I've heard, actually, there are toy guillotines
really?
Around in Paris.
Oh, well, are there images of you in effigy?
I doubt it very much, actually. But certainly, actually, some of my colleagues, I think, actually, when my name is mentioned, drown it out with choruses of the Marseillaise. I'm going in December, I think, actually, when I may slip in incognito and hope my notoriety, you know, won't be noticed so much then. There's a wonderful exhibition at the Louvre of Jacques-Louis David, and I'm certainly going to go see that later in the year.
Well, Simon Schumm, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome.